From the heartland of America, the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. A little bit later on, Richard Belzer joins us as we talk about JFK and that incredible story, of course. Well, this is it, the Thanksgiving week. Get ready. We'll talk more about that later on this week. Here's what's happening. A Tennessee bus driver has been charged with 5 counts of vehicular homicide, reckless endangerment, reckless driving after 6 children were killed, 23 others injured when the vehicle crashed into a house Monday afternoon. What a horrible story. The Chattanooga police chief has announced the charges for 24-year-old Johnny Walker in a press conference late on Monday. Oh, sad story indeed. Well, a few bad days for police over the weekend, too, nationwide. The suspect in the murder of a San Antonio police detective has now been arrested. San Antonio Police Chief William McGannis says that the 31-year-old Otis Tyrone McCain was taken into custody without incident. In the St. Louis area, St. Louis Police Sergeant was shot twice in the face Sunday evening when he sat in traffic in a marked police vehicle. The sergeant was released from the hospital. The shooter killed later on by police and police officers were shot and injured during traffic stops in Sanibel, Florida, Gladstone, Missouri on Sunday night. Unbelievable why police are being targeted this way. Authorities have identified a construction worker who was killed in Massachusetts when a power saw that he was using kicked backwards and slit him in the throat. He died. A magnitude 6.9 earthquake struck off the coast of Fukushima in northeast Japan, sending residents fleeing to higher ground and prompting worries about the power plant there destroyed by the tsunami 5 years ago. Lines of cars were seen snaking away from the coast in the pre-dawn hours after authorities issued a tsunami warning. The earthquake quake struck in the same region that was devastated by the 2011 tsunami, which killed some 18,000 people. Scott Portzline, of course, has researched all kinds of things with sabotage, terrorism of nuclear power plants. He's with us here. Scott, that's another scary situation in Japan, but I got to tell you, with all these earthquake warnings along the western coast of the United States, we've got nuke plants all over the place there, don't we?
Well, we have two that are still open in California that at the Diablo Canyon that could cause us trouble, and there's still spent fuel pools that are storing spent fuel at other nuclear plants. So, yeah, we have a real worry here. But what happened in Japan today occurred at the Fukushima Daiichi, which is a different set of reactors than the ones that were destroyed in 2011.
Oh, geez.
That was Fukushima Daiichi. This was Fukushima Daiichi. And they had initial reports coming out that had me very worried, saying that they lost cooling at reactor number 3.
Mm.
But the facts were they lost cooling or the flow of water through the spent fuel pool at Unit 3, which isn't nearly as worrisome because they have time to react to that. In fact, it was the coolant was restored through the pools about 90 minutes later, and the temperature of the spent fuel pool had only risen 1 degree. So in the sense of luck, were we lucky? We were lucky the quake wasn't bigger or closer to the reactor. And even then, the magnitude of an earthquake isn't an exacting measure because some quakes shake laterally much more than other quakes. Some quakes shake up and down or diagonally. But in this case, the Japanese are actually reporting a 7.4 magnitude quake. The U.S. is saying 6.9. This was felt as far away as Tokyo, and of course they had tsunami warnings like they did in 2011, but it was actually the quaking this time that shut down some of the equipment. It responded automatically to the loss of some of the flow through the spent fuel pool, and then the workers were able to do a walk down, look at all the systems. No damage was observed at any of the nuclear power plants in Japan. So in that sense, it was good news.
Scott, I want to have you back for an extended interview so we could talk about the possibility of terrorism at some of our nuke plants as well. So get ready for that. A storm system is bringing wintry weather to the northeast, dumping up to 18 inches of snow in parts of upstate New York. Old man winter is here. The mosquito-borne Zika virus will no longer be treated as an international medical emergency, according to the World Health Organization. They basically are saying it is no longer an emergency. The infection has been linked to severe birth defects in almost 30 countries. Let's check in, though, with the expert on pandemics, Dr. Gary Ridenour. Gary, basically the WHO's decision to call this no longer an emergency, what does that really mean?
Well, actually, it starts off with the song, "Where Have All the Zikas Gone? Long Time Passing."
Yeah.
The last case was in September. We had 139 cases in the United States only, George. Worldwide, one child dies of hunger every 10 seconds. So the Zikas have quieted down, so the CDC pulled their public health emergency warning. But in return, they received $1.8 billion from the Obama administration for vaccine research. And I've got a book on Kindle called Zika Conspiracy, and it follows the money trail on how these mosquitoes were spread and overreported. And now these so-called crooks have gotten out of the mosquito business and are investing their stock in certain vaccine companies to reap the profits.
Gary, it's shocking the way they manipulate these diseases in order to scare people.
It is, and India has three cases against the Gates Foundation for crimes against humanity for killing over 100,000 people with experimental vaccines, cotton seeds, and also a polio virus vaccine that paralyzed 46,000 people.
All right, Gary, thank you. Dr. Gary Ridenour, of course, expert on pandemics. Apple has admitted that some iPhone 6S devices can suddenly shut down for no apparent reason. The tech giant is offering owners of the problematic smartphones free replacement batteries, just so you know that. You know, in the past, Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, has been just that, a one-day shopping spree, either online, retailers. Now retailers like Amazon say, hey, we're changing things. Amazon has begun 35 straight days of Black Friday bargains this week. Even Macy's is jumping in, getting started a little earlier as well. Let's check in with the registered investment advisor, Michael Shedlock. Is this a sign that they're scared because sales could be low? What is this, Michael?
I think so, George, but you know, it's no longer Black Friday anywhere. No need to camp out.
It's all month long. It's already started.
Yes, it has started. You know, stores are opening on Thanksgiving Day. They're trying to compete with, compete with Amazon, of course. And then, so Amazon turns around. What do? They announce weeks worth of this stuff. So the whole tradition has gone down the drain. George, I don't know what retail sales will be, but I will tell you this. Whatever the reports come out on Friday, don't believe them, because they're estimates based off of traffic, not how much people are spending. I've got an idea here for you, George. It's what my wife Liz and I decided to do. We're not going to buy each other Christmas gifts. Instead, we're going to donate money for autism, to the Left Turner ALS Foundation for ALS research, to the Nature Conservancy. We're going to add another one to that list, and that's what we're going to do for this Christmas.
Well, that's a good sign. Mish, thanks so much. Good talking to you again. You have a great Thanksgiving with your family. In a moment, can the dollar collapse? Jim Rickards joins us. We talk about his work, including The Road to Ruin, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie here, along with Jim Rickards. Jim is the editor of the newsletter Strategic Intelligence, a member of the advisory board of the Center for Financial Economics at Johns Hopkins as well. He's been an advisor on international economics and financial threats to the Department of Defense. and he has served as a facilitator of the first ever financial war games conducted by the Pentagon. Jim, welcome back. Always good to have you.
Thank you, George. Great to be with you again.
That must have been fun, being the financial war games advisor. How did that work?
Well, it really was. It was fun. It was serious work, of course, but sure. It was really, really enjoyable. You know, the Pentagon had been doing war games for decades. They didn't need any help from me in terms of putting a war game together. But where they did need help, this was the first ever financial war game. And you always have rules, rules of engagement, and our rules were you could not use anything kinetic. You could not use anything that would shoot or explode, missiles or whatever. All the weapons had to be financial, so stocks, bonds, currencies, derivatives, gold, commodities, etc. Now, we had the usual teams. So there was a Russia team, a China team, a U.S. We played it at a top-secret weapons laboratory. It's about halfway between Washington and Baltimore, called the Applied Physics Laboratory. And they host a lot of these war games, not just ours, but others. And, you know, it's kind of what you might picture, a big room. You've got big screens, kind of big panel TV screens around the room. There's a stage. There's separate seating areas for each team, and then there are observation areas. There's one booth in the back. We kind of darkened glass. I noticed there was a three-star general in there, part of it, just kind of coming in as an observer. And then we had breakout rooms. They were like embassies, if you will, where you could go just with your team and caucus. And then we all had computers and a scroll where you could type and comment. Other people could comment on you. It was just wild. I'd love to see the consolidated scroll that became a property of the Office of the Secretary of Defense. I never saw the whole thing, but I saw, you know, my contributions and what other people were doing. But I called it playing Risk for adults. We got to make up the rules and play the game.
Jim, the stock market is holding strong. Housing starts looked great in October. Is this a false sense of a great economic boom here or what?
George, that is a great question. It's the question I've been working with and writing about and thinking about since the election of Donald Trump as our 45th president. No doubt that obviously the stock market's reaching new highs every day. That's fairly easy to explain in the following sense. So you know, during the election campaign, so many people had problems with Trump's behavior and all the stories and, you know, some vulgar behavior and all that, that very few people could get past his personality and look at his policies. But when you actually look at the policies, what is he calling for? Lower taxes, a lot more infrastructure spending, wants to spend money on, you know, highways, bridges, roads, airports, and all that, more money on defense, and less regulation. By the way, that's the Ronald Reagan playbook, low taxes, less regulation, and
well,
a lot,
right,
in Reagan's case, defense spending. So I'll come back to that in a second. But so you look at the stock market. So pharmaceutical stocks are going up because he wants to get rid of Obamacare. John Deere and Caterpillar are going up because he wants to spend more on construction. You know, Raytheon, Lockheed, Boeing, all the defense stocks, they're going up because he's going to spend more on defense. Kind of everything's going up because if you cut taxes, people have more money to invest. So, you know, you can go sector by sector, but it's a little bit euphoric. But I step back and say, well, look, these might even be good policies. You know, nothing wrong with cutting taxes, nothing wrong with less regulation. I think that's probably good for growth. But this is a very different environment than when Ronald Reagan ran the same playbook. And by the way, a lot of Trump's advisors, not all of them, but a lot of them, are from the Reagan Revolution. I mean, you're looking at Steve Moore, Larry Kudlow, Art Laffer, and others. These were David Malpass. These were all people who were at cabinet or sub-cabinet level appointments with Ronald Reagan. Now they're back. You know, they were kind of in their 40s then. Now they're in their 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same playbook. But Ronald Reagan played it against a high school football team. Trump's going up against the New England Patriots. And what I mean by that was when Ronald Reagan was sworn in, interest rates were 20%. January 1981, interest rates were 20%. Inflation was 15%. And we were just going into, at the time, the worst recession since
World War. Right, and we were getting out of that Arab oil embargo. That was a disaster.
Correct. We were digging out from under a lot of headwinds. So in a sense, interest rates had nowhere to go but down. Inflation had nowhere to go but down. And most importantly, the debt-to-GDP ratio, how much debt did the United States have relative to the size of our economy? It was 35% when Reagan took office. When he left, it was 55%. Now, 55 is still not too high as nations go. You look at, you know, Japan's 240%. Greece is 120%. But Reagan had a lot of fiscal headroom. He could run deficits and not bankrupt the country. Now look at the situation with Trump. He wants to run the same policies. The debt to GDP ratio today is 105%. That's in like red alert territory.
Yeah.
So in other words, if you cut taxes and do $1 trillion of infrastructure spending, throw $1 trillion of debt on top of the $20 trillion we already have, Trump has much less flexibility than Reagan. I'm not saying these are bad policies. I'm saying the environment. Trump has headwinds. Reagan had tailwinds. The economy almost had nowhere to go but up. I would say that Reagan had good policies, but even if he didn't, even if someone else had been president, the economy probably would have done pretty well because we were coming out of such a bad patch. It couldn't have gotten much worse. Well, interest rates weren't going to go to 30%. They were already at 20%. They had to come down. So we had a bond market rally as interest rates and inflation came down. We had a stock market rally as Reagan, you know, did what he said, cut taxes, cut regulation, and, you know, more defense spending. So, again, same playbook, but very, very different environment for Trump. Trump's facing extreme headwinds. It's going to be difficult for him to do what he says he wants to do. And then you've got a lot of conflicts within the Trump camp. You've got people like David Malpass and Mike Pence, who are kind of, Steve Moore and Mike Pence, who are free traders. Then you've got people like Steve Bannon and David Malpass, who think we ought to renegotiate all these trade deals. Now, again, I don't want to get in the middle of that. You can argue both ways, but that's a big difference. It looks like Trump's leaning to blowing up these trade deals. Said today he would get rid of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I've been out in Asia a lot, spent a lot of time with recently with the former Malaysian Prime Minister. That's going to make them turn to China. And so what does that do for U.S. trade? So my point is, I think some of Trump's policies are good. He is running the Reagan playbook, as I said, but in a very difficult, more challenging environment. The big issue is, will the Fed accommodate it? If Trump wants to run, you know, trillion-dollar deficits, which is what they're talking about, will the Fed maintain an easy monetary policy? If they do, you're definitely going to get inflation. But if the Fed leans in against inflation, it raises rates more aggressively than people expect, that could throw the economy into a recession. So the way I describe it, we're right on the knife edge. We could have that 70s-style inflation. We could have something that looks more like the 1930s-style depression. Investors really need to be nimble here and have some protection against both and probably a lot of cash so you can be nimble.
What about the globalists, Jim? I mean, the globalists who want this one world government, who want a one world economy, how are they handling all this?
Well, I talk about that a lot in my book, The Road to Ruin. I call them the global elite, but yes, you're right, they are the globalists. And I make the point, we know who they are. It's not some deep, dark conspiracy. They don't sit around a boardroom mahogany table with hoods on, you know, kind of like a Specter in a James Bond movie, although they operate a little bit that way. But they have names and faces. It's, you know, Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, Mario Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, professors like Larry Summers and Kenneth Rogoff at Harvard University. I could list a lot of names, David Lipton at the IMF, but the point is the real people, they're in institutions like the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the Federal Reserve, they're professors, they're public intellectuals, they take turns in these different offices. And they have a long-term plan, really a long-term view of it. This goes back to a philosopher named Karl Popper, who is George Soros' favorite philosopher, by the way. I mean, Karl Popper's most famous book was called The Open Society and Its Enemies. George Soros' main foundation, his main think tank, is called the Open Society Foundation, named in honor of Karl Popper, obviously. But Popper proposed the idea of piecemeal social engineering. He said, look, we have a plan. We know it's unpopular. We know it would never be approved in any democracy around the world. So what we need to do is just one slice at a time. But most importantly, never give it back. It might be 10, 20 years between, you know, significant points of progress, but you never give it back. And over a longer period of time, meaning 50 years or 75 years, you end up basically taking control of society. So for that elite, Trump is a setback. He's not part of that elite. I know a lot of Americans say, oh, he's rich and he's glamorous. He must be part of the elite. He really isn't. I mean, he is wealthy and he's a celebrity and he's very well known. But you know, he doesn't go to Davos, the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. He's never been invited to Bilderberg. That's this group of financial and corporate elites who meet once a year. He doesn't go to the Milken Institute or the Aspen Ideas Festival. These are the kind of hangouts of the global elite that I described. He's not really in that crowd. He's not one of them. He's not beholden to them. So what they'll do two things. On the one hand, they'll just kind of hunker down, right? Just, okay, presidents come and go. Prime ministers come and go, but the global elite is permanent.
They are stayed fast, aren't they?
Do. And now, of course, individuals die. You get old and you die. We wish them all a long life, but George Soros is 80, in his mid-80s. He's not going to live forever, but they know that. And they train the next generation, their proteges. A great example is Bob Rubin.
Hold on for a second, Jim. We're going to come up to the break here, but let's come right back and talk about that. And talking about George Soros, of course, knowing him, he'll clone himself, download his memory, and he'll live forever. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Jim Rickards with us. His latest book, The Road to Ruin, but the scary part is the subtitle, The Global Elite's Secret Plan for the Next Financial Crisis, which we'll talk about. And Jim, I think you're under the impression that they are going to concoct the next financial crisis?
Well, that's one of the standard techniques, and I have a section in my book, George, called The Shock Doctrine. Now, The Shock Doctrine, the name comes from a book written some years ago by a lady named Naomi Klein, but the basic idea has been around a long time. And what it says is that the global elites have an agenda, and it's one world government, world taxation, and world money. It sounds, spooky and scary, but believe me, there's a lot of documentation to back this up. They're moving in that direction. I can tell you what the institutions are. The world money is the something called the Special Drawing Right, the SDR. It's printed by the International Monetary Fund. The International Monetary Fund itself acts like a central bank of the world. It has a kind of board of directors. These are the leaders of the G20. G stands for group. So it's the group of 20 nations. So they're the board of directors. So, and then, of course, you have the United Nations and the World Bank and other institutions. So this whole architecture is in place. It exists today. The question is, how quickly can they advance the agenda of actually getting the kind of control they want? So the idea of the shock doctrine is that there's a lot of things that are very unpalatable. If you went to an everyday citizen in the United States, or for that matter in France or Italy or the UK or Japan, and said, here's what I want to do. I want to invade your privacy. I want to control your media. I want to basically take away freedom of choice and give you a kind of money that's completely unaccountable. Everyone would say, no, I don't want that. But what they do is they wait for a shock. It could be a natural disaster, like the Fukushima tidal mm-hmm. wave and nuclear meltdown. It could be a financial disaster, like 2008. It could be a world war. But whatever it is, when these things come, people are very fearful. They're very afraid. So the elites kind of come out of hiding, and they're not really in hiding, but kind of come out of the woodwork and say, well, we can save you. We have this plan. And then everyone says, sure, I'll sign up for that. And then they implement it. And the next thing you know, you've given up some of your liberty, and you never get it back. Perfect example is the Patriot Act, which came right after
9/11. Oh, my God, yeah.
9/11.
They just slammed that through, and everybody went for it.
Right. Now, there were parts of it that I would say were probably good, but there were other parts of it that were just sitting on the shelf at the Treasury Department. It was, let's call it, the Treasury Department's wish list in terms of the war on cash and taking away people's ability to have cash, the ability to do certain transactions, et cetera. And they just pull that off the shelf. They stick it in the Patriot Act. It gets hooted through the Congress, and then, as I say, you never get it back. That's one example. So the question is, Trump is not part of this global elite. As I say, he's rich and famous, but he's not really one of them. He doesn't share their agenda. They can at least hunker down. They won't go away. And as I was talking earlier about Bob Rubin, he's probably, just look at his resume. He was CEO of Goldman Sachs. Then he was U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. Then he was chairman of the board of Citibank. And then he's now chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. How's that for a resume?
Yeah, he's got them all. He's got all the globalist titles.
he punched every ticket. But he has created a cadre of proteges. And I dare say most people have never heard of these names, and why should they? People have better things to do than study all this. This is sort of what I do in researching my books. People like Lael Brainard, who is on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, Mike Froman, who was in the White House, he was Obama's chief eyes and ears at these G20 meetings. He's now the U.S. Trade Representative. He negotiates these trade deals. Timothy Geithner, who was the Secretary of the Treasury, and David Lipton, who's the first Deputy Managing Director of the IMF. They all were hired, trained by Rubin at the Treasury and then later at Citigroup, and they're all there. So Rubin may pass from the scene at some point, but Brainerd and Lipton and the others, they'll be around for a long time. And they're all like-minded. They all went to the same schools, you know, whether it was Harvard or MIT or Chicago or Stanford. A lot of them were each other's professors. You know, Stan Fisher, the vice chairman of the Fed, he was the PhD thesis advisor to a lot of other central bankers around the world. So, as I say, it's not a top-down conspiracy. They're like-minded. They share these values. They never go away. They train younger protégés so that the cause continues beyond them. So, in their mind, the presidents come and go. But you could accelerate the process. You could cause a panic. And believe me, when I saw, so Trump's elected November 8th, you know, now president-elect of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The same day, the Prime Minister of India, Modi, comes out, and out of the blue, he says, the 500 rupee note and the 1,000 rupee note are no longer legal tender. Now, by the way, that's equivalent to about a $5 bill and a $20
All right,
bill.
And why would he say that?
Well, now he says he wants to get tax evaders, right? He said, so that money in your pocket. So imagine, this is the equivalent, George. Imagine the President of the United States waking up, going on TV, saying, fives, tens, and twenties are no longer legal tender. That's not money anymore.
Right. If you have them, so what, right?
So what do you have to do? You can take them down to the bank and deposit them, right? But, of course, the tax man's waiting there saying, well, where'd you get the money, right? And then, on top of that, that when you put it in the bank, it's now in digital form. So they can impose negative interest rates. See, if you put $100,000 in the bank and I have $100,000 and I take cash and we have negative interest rates, that's where they take your money away. So 1% negative interest rate. A year later, you've got $99,000
right.
because they took $1,000 out. But I still got my $100,000 because I had cash. So they have to eliminate cash in order to impose negative interest rates. And the way I describe this, if you're going to slaughter cattle, you got to herd them into a pen. And if you're going to steal from savers, you have to herd them into a digital pen at the banks. And then you can take their money with negative interest rates. So if you're going to have negative interest rates, which is a kind of tax or confiscation, the first thing you have to do is get rid of cash. And this is going on all over the world. About 6 months ago, the European Central Bank abolished the 500 euro note. They still have a 200 euro note. But they said the 500 euro note is no longer legal tender. We're not going to make anymore. If you have old ones, they're still good.
Well, Jim, but if you poll people, how many people are holding on or hoarding cash as opposed to just keeping it in the bank?
Well, it's probably relatively few. That's true. But people think, see, the thing is, sure, they think they can get it. And you actually can't. You actually can't get your cash. So you're captive. You tell yourself you can get it. You tell yourself you have money. You know, people have money in money market funds. It's one of the great misnomers. People say, oh, I've got money in the money market fund. I can call my broker, sell my units. The money will be in the bank the next day. How many people know that in the last 6 months, the Securities Exchange Commission changed the rules so that for the first
time.
That's
right. That's one of our clients, Lear Capital, gold company and silver,
right.
Just told me 2 weeks ago, and they do it in our commercials, about the money market disaster of the foreign investments. But I'll have you explain it.
Well, they can. First of all, they can suspend redemptions. That means they don't have to give you your money back. They can just say, we're going to, just like a hedge fund. Hedge fund has gates. They can close the door. So people might find that they can't get their money back. Now, the second thing that happened is there are two kinds of money market funds. One of them can invest in any kind of high-grade, what's called commercial paper, bank CDs. So you might have a Deutsche Bank or German Bank or UK Bank, IOU in there. The other kind invests in government securities only. Well, guess what? The rule change that I just talked about where they can suspend redemptions or pay you less than a dollar. It used to be if you put a dollar in, you got a dollar out, you know, with interest. The interest might be low, but you got your dollar back. Now they don't have to give you your dollar back. They could give you 98 cents or 95 cents or whatever, kind of whatever the market will bear, or they can suspend redemptions and not pay you at all. Well, that kind of money market fund is was investing in these other instruments that I talked about. But that rule doesn't apply if it's pure government security. So guess what the brokers did? They sent everybody a notice. They said, we're moving you from this so-called prime money market fund that had the foreign notes in it to a U.S. government fund. And isn't that good because now they can't freeze your money? Well, think about it. You've just been forced to lend money to the U.S. government. You are now a forced buyer of U.S. government securities. That's how desperate the government is. So when you look behind all these things, there are many, many examples I could give you, George, but it's all pointing in the same direction. Get people into a small number of banks, get them into digital form, take away the ability to have cash, and then you're going to get slaughtered with either taxes or negative interest rates or freezes. And I talked about this in my book, The Road to Ruin. I call it ICE 9. And I don't know if ICE 9 is familiar to a lot of the listeners, but it's something I took from a 1963 novel by Kurt Vonnegut, you know, great writer, great science fiction writer and novelist. And he had this, it was basically a doomsday machine. He wrote this book in 1963, Cat's Cradle, right after the Cuban Missile Crisis. ICE 9 was a special molecule invented by this mad scientist called Honecker. And it was exactly like water, except for two things. The melting temperature was 114.4 degrees Fahrenheit, which meant that it was frozen at room temperature. And the other characteristic, if a molecule of ICE 9 came in contact with a molecule of water, the water would turn to ICE 9. So what he did, he put it in vials and gave it to his kids. And the plot of the novel was, you know, would you open it and pour it into a stream? Well, if you did, the stream would freeze, then a river, then a bay, then the ocean. All the water in the world would freeze and life on Earth would die. So that was the doomsday machine behind ICE 9. I took that story by Kurt Vonnegut and I applied it to the freezing of financial assets, to the freezing of the financial system. So let's say we have another panic like the one in 2008, which, by the way, is definitely coming. It's a separate topic as to why that's true.
Everybody feels it. Everybody feels
it. Definitely coming. So now there's a panic. So what does everybody do? They call their money market funds and say, I want my money back. Well, the money market funds shut their doors. They say, we're using this new authority. We're not giving you your money back. So
you can't even write a check against it.
Can't write a check against it. Can't do anything. So that part's frozen. So then people go to the banks and say, well, I'll take my money out of the bank. They close the banks, which is exactly what Franklin Roosevelt did in 1933. Then you go to sell your stocks, and they close the stock exchange and so forth. And it's just like my point is, you can't freeze part of the system because the demand for cash will just move to a different part.
To a different way.
So you have to keep freezing everything and lock down the whole system.
Well, that's a complete shutdown.
It is a complete shutdown. It's coming. And the reason I say that, to illustrate that in my book, pardon me.
Get some water there. Got any water there?
Yeah, I do.
Take
thank
a little
you.
Drink.
I look at three crises. 1998, 2008, 10 years later, and then I go forward 10 years to 2018 just to keep up that 10-year tempo.
Okay.
So what happened in 1998? That was the Russia default long-term capital management crisis. That was a hedge fund that owed $1 trillion to Wall Street. By the way, I was their lawyer. I negotiated that bailout, so I had a front-row seat on that one. So we were hours away from shutting every exchange in the world. Now, Wall Street got together, you know, ponied up $4 billion, propped up the balance sheet, and the Fed cut interest rates, and life went on. The world didn't come to an end, but it was that close, just hours away, and there were people standing in the way. There's all kinds of dramatics behind the scene that people never knew about. Talk about it in my book. 10 years later, almost 10 years to the day, we were days away from the sequential collapse of every bank in the world. So Bear Stearns had failed in March 08. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac failed in June of 2008. Lehman Brothers failed in September of 2008. Morgan Stanley was a couple days away, then Goldman, then Citibank, then Bank of America, then J.P. Morgan. They all would have collapsed, except the Fed intervened at a certain point, printed $10 trillion, and gave it to the European Central Bank so they could bail out their own banks. You know, the European banks had a liquidity crisis in dollars.
With nothing backing the dollars, of course. Nothing.
Nothing backing the dollars, nothing backing the euros. The European Central Bank printed up 10 trillion euros. The Federal Reserve printed up $10 trillion. They swapped them so the European Central Bank could have dollars to bail out their own banks.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got the euros. By the way, none of this was known at the time.
And what are the euros worth? Nothing, right?
Well, they're all just based on confidence. And we say it's not backed by anything. That's true in terms of hard assets. But it is backed by confidence. But the problem is confidence is fragile. It can be very easily lost.
At any time,
overnight, and that's also what I talk about in the book, how quickly these panics can evolve. So that was 2008. And then I talk about a third crisis in 2018. But don't be complacent and say, oh, we're good till 2018. That's just an example. It could be tomorrow. But here's the point, George. In 1998, Wall Street bailed out a hedge fund. In 2008, the central banks bailed out Wall Street. In 2018, who's going to bail out the central banks? Each bailout gets bigger than the one before. You need a bigger balance sheet to bail you out. And there's only one balance sheet in the world bigger than the central banks. That's the International Monetary Fund. That's the World Central Bank. And they're going to do it with this world money the special drawing rights, and that's going to be the end of the dollar. It doesn't mean dollars go away. We'll still have dollars, but they'll be like Mexican pesos. It'll be like a local currency. You and I will have it for walking around money, but it won't be the benchmark global reserve currency. You know, the price.
And when will all this happen? By 2018?
Well, 2018 is a target. That's an estimate. But here's my point. It could happen tomorrow. It's like watching, I use the metaphor, the snowflake and the avalanche. So it's snowing. There's snow building up on the side of a mountain. Any expert can look at it and say, that is unstable. It's going to collapse. It's going to come cascading down, maybe kill a few skiers, bury a village below. But you don't know exactly when. Now, one snowflake hits the wrong way, disturbs a couple other snowflakes. That gathers momentum. You get a chute. You get a slide. It gathers more momentum. It rips away from the mountain. And there's your avalanche.
But you think sooner than later.
I do think, well, I definitely think sooner than later. And there's good science behind it, George. It's not just a guess. They're like, oh, gee, you know, these things happen every so often. By the way, they do happen every so often. But this is an example of applied complexity theory. And complexity theory has these what are called self-organized critical states. It's when just human nature and behavior and interconnectedness and the diversity of different agents, you know, you have bulls and bears and longs and shorts and fear and greed, and the sheer size of the system gathered to the point that it just collapses on itself. Now, you go out, I don't know if you're a skier, but you go out to Aspen Highlands early in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, go way up around 12,000 feet, you'll see the ski patrol setting off dynamite charges. What are they doing? They're causing little avalanches.
So there won't be a big one.
Correct. But we're not doing that. We're making the fault lines bigger. We're making the snow pile bigger. The five biggest banks in the United States today, the ones, you know, 2008, what did you hear? Too big to fail. Those big five banks today, they are bigger than they were in 2008. They have a larger percentage of all the assets, and they have much larger derivatives books. In other words, everything that was too big to fail in 2008 is bigger, more densely connected, more dangerous today than it was then. We haven't learned any of the lessons, and so you can absolutely see this coming.
Jeez, scary. So this will not bode well for a Donald Trump campaign and presidency.
Well, that's the point. This is, I like to say an avalanche doesn't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican. These are large, complex systems. These are unstable, dynamic forces.
And he can't stop it, can he?
He can't stop it. He can hope that it doesn't happen, although my estimate is that it will. But when it happens, you know, remember what happened in 2008? Hank Paulson, Secretary of the Treasury, and Ben Bernanke, who at the time was Chairman of the Fed, walked over to the White House, and they said, Mr. President, you have to do this. You have to bail out the banks. If not, the entire economy is going to grind to a halt. And Bernanke's face was white. So what was George Bush going to do? I mean, George Bush wasn't an economist. I mean, he was a politician.
He had to listen to these guys.
He did, and he went along with it. This is a perfect example of what we were talking about earlier, the shock doctrine. When you're confronted with this. Now, the interesting thing about Trump, he is a little bit of a wild card. He might call their bluff. He might say, you know, let it rip. You know, the U.S. will be fine. If China goes down or the rest of the world goes down, that's their problem. I'm sick of bailing out these banks. You know, and he might just, and that will get very interesting because it won't stop the collapse, but you will get a very different outcome. That now, so we're talking about hyperinflation if you print these SDRs, you know, trillions of SDRs, or are we talking about a Great Depression scenario if the U.S. kind of hunkers down? Let's hope it doesn't happen. I've had the Financial Times read my first book. They said, let's hope he's wrong. I said, I hope I'm wrong.
But Jim, his advisors have got to be telling him about these possibilities.
My problem, George, is I think it's pretty low on his list. I mean, this is theoretical stuff. Now, again, my book, The Road to Ruin, it has 151 endnotes. Now, readers don't have to read them. The book is written in a very accessible way. It's not a textbook. I'm not writing for professors. It has sort of PhD level content, but it's written in plain English. I get rid of the jargon, I make it very accessible. But if you want to go to the endnotes and look at the sources, what you'll discover is that all of the claims I'm making are very well documented. They're in official documents from whether it's the IMF or the Bank for International Settlements or the G20. I like to call these institutions transparently non-transparent. And what I mean by that, they actually do put a lot of stuff on their website. But it might be like 15 layers deep, and you need technical training to understand it. They write in jargon. I certainly don't expect everyday people to the people have better things to do than read it, but it's what I do when I research my books, and I just sort of, you know, put the message out there in plain English.
Okay, we're going to come back in a moment and take phone calls with Jim Rickards. His latest book, of course, is called The Road to Ruin. Jim's website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and he's got a Twitter feed, too, at James G. Rickards, R-I-C-K-A-R-D-S. Okay, at James G. Rickards. And we're going to come back and take your calls next on Coast to Coast AM.